everybody, and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Marshall Poe, your host. Each week we pick a history book that we find particularly interesting, and we interview the author of that book. This week we're happy to have Ian McNeely on the show, and we'll be talking about his new book, Reinventing Knowledge, From Alexandria to the Internet. The co-author of the book is Lisa Wolverton, and it's just come out from W.W. Norton. I've written on the history of media myself, and I have to say that I found Ian's take on the topic extraordinarily refreshing and interesting. I studied the history of media technology, whereas Ian and Lisa have focused on, I guess, what might be called media institutions. Media might be the wrong word, but in any event, he and she deal with a number of institutions that have been important in the creation and dissemination of knowledge from ancient Greece to the present. Specifically, they are the library, the monastery, the university, the Republic of Letters, the disciplines, and the laboratory. It's a really interesting take on the topic, and I found it very refreshing and extraordinarily enlightening. It's such a great pleasure to speak with someone who is so well-versed in the topic. So it's quite obvious that I really enjoyed talking to Ian today, and I hope that you enjoyed the interview. Here it is. Hi, Ian.
Hi, Marshall.
How are you today?
Fine, thanks.
Very well. You're in Oregon, is that correct?
That's right, Eugene.
And how is Eugene?
It's a little cloudy right now, believe it or not.
Yeah.
But during the summer, we usually have quite nice weather.
Yeah, actually, I spent a summer in Seattle once, and it was actually quite lovely. I spent a summer in Seattle twice, and it was quite lovely. So, no, here in Iowa, we have heat and humidity. That's what we have. So, anyway, let me just tell our listeners that we're happy to have Ian McNeely on the show today, who has written a book with Lisa Wolverton called Reinventing Knowledge, From Alexandria to the Internet. It's just come out from W.W. Norton. And I've read the book, and I think it's really terrific. It's kind of a model for the way that popular history should be written, and I really look forward to talking to you about it. But first, why don't we start by asking you to tell us a little bit about yourself, that is, where you were born and grew up and where you went to school and, you know, that kind of thing, just some biographical detail.
Sure. I was born in Gainesville, Florida, which is in some ways the Eugene of the South, a university town in the middle of Florida. Really benefited, even though my folks weren't faculty members, from the proximity of the university. And, you know, one of the sort of biographical bits that wound up very circuitously inspiring the book was when I got my first computer, an Apple II Plus, in 1980, which had fully 64K of RAM. Mm-hmm. And that seemed in those days to be kind of miraculous.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I started out very much wanting to be a techie, a computer guy, to start a computer revolution of some kind.
Mm-hmm.
And somewhere along the way, late high school, early college, I got derailed from that and wound up in history.
Mm-hmm. I mean, any particular reason?
I really, at some point, I, you know, sort of absorbed the notion that even a computer techie, especially computer techie, should be, you know, well-versed in the classics and
sure.
have a well-rounded liberal education. And then there was a class called Theory of Knowledge in my high school as part of the International Baccalaureate program, where we read things like Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Making.
Uh-huh.
let's see what else. The Structure of Scientific Revolutions.
Uh-huh. Sure, yeah.
That was my Nietzsche phase that I think many 16-year-olds, males especially, go through. I went around declaring God is dead.
Sure, yeah. No, that was, yeah, I remember that as well.
Yeah, yeah. I'm still trying to figure out why adults read Nietzsche, but that's a separate issue.
Yeah, we should talk more about that because
I
wonder about those things too.
Well, I don't want to offend anybody. I mean, I came out of high school with really these twin interests. I think, if I remember correctly, we were supposed to read the Odyssey in this class, and I skipped it, and I made up for it during the summer before college by reading the whole series of epic poems, the Odyssey, the Iliad, et cetera.
Yeah.
Once I got to college, I wandered into a couple of history classes, one on 19th century Vienna, one on 19th century Europe generally, one on ancient Greece, and I really just sort of progressively got pulled away from the computing, took a very long 20-year detour into European and specifically German history, which is what I was trained in.
Yeah,
but a lot of those early interests that I had in in computing and its implications for knowledge, really came back when I had the luxury of writing this book.
Yeah. So then you went on to graduate school, and you were trained as a German historian. Is that right? Where did you go to graduate school?
The University of Michigan.
Uh-huh. And actually, it's funny. I spent some time in Ann Arbor. And who did you study with there?
Jeff Ely and Kathleen Canning.
Sure, yeah. I don't think I've ever met Jeff Ely, but I know the department quite well because Val Kivelson, who's a colleague of mine, is in the department. So,
uh-huh.
Yeah, and we're both Muscovite historians, yeah. So and then you wrote a book about writing in Germany, is that correct?
Yeah, my sort of dissertation book was about a group of these kind of they were scribes. They were notaries public, really had a very lowly position in the communities of southwestern Germany after the French Revolution, but sort of manipulated their roles as amanuenses or as sort of mouthpieces of their clients to stage all types of political machinations and try to get the constitution restored and things
right,
like that.
Right.
There was a way in which I tried to pursue these interests that I had in knowledge and information and writing through the framework of German history, and that was the first real book that I did.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, I mean, you make an interesting point in something that I think surprises most people, and that is that in the pre-modern world, people that wrote were generally quite they were of low class. That it was a servile occupation. It's true in Russia as well. I mean, they were really the lowest of the low. People they had the status of people that like cleaned buildings.
right.
Yeah, they just had this technical skill, but they were by no means what we would think of as sort of highbrow intellectuals. Yeah.
Yeah, and I've always been motivated. I mean, going back to my personal biography, it's a kind of a county in Gainesville. I've always been interested in the boundary between establishment intellectuals and those who have pretensions and aspirations of being intellectuals.
Yeah.
Who don't quite make the grade status-wise.
Right.
And so, if I were to psychologize myself, I would say that as a townie in a university town, I had a special sympathy for those, sort of trying to, bang down the campus walls.
Yeah, no, exactly. No,
the ivy.
Right. So maybe you could tell us how you came to write this book with Lisa.
After grad school, which I loved, I mean, Michigan was, really the most intense intellectual community I'd ever experienced.
Mm-hmm.
I was fortunate enough to win a postdoc at the Harvard Society of Fellows, which is a three-year postdoc that imposes absolutely no requirements whatsoever, except that you attend three lavishly catered meals a week.
Uh-huh.
On Monday nights they serve lots of alcohol, and they're like crippling you for the rest of the week.
Yeah, I've actually been there a couple times. I spent some time at Harvard, and I used to go to the dinners there. I know about the dinners and their famous wine cellar.
Yeah, exactly. And I had ambitions of becoming the wine.
It's funny because my friend, a very intelligent fellow named Curtis Perry, taught me to say that it's a. How does he put it? It's a large, well-stratified world that gives the appearance of being small. And so my sister-in-law was actually the wine steward at the Society of Fellows, and my brother-in-law was there as well. He wasn't a member, but he was there with her. So yeah, I know about the Society. It's a good gig.
Yeah, no, and far be it for me to look a gift horse in the mouth.
No way.
I did experience a certain loss of intellectual community there.
No,
it is very. I mean, the postdoc was originally designed in the 30s to release people from the rigors of the PhD and the kind of career ladder that implied. And I found now it's simply a diversion from that or an opportunity to sort of bolster your CV even more.
Yeah.
So I sort of got, as I say, very cryptically in the acknowledgments of the book, a critical perspective on academic institutions from inhabiting, what I like to call the kind of, the musty attic at the very top of the ivory tower.
Yeah.
And that's where I met Lisa, my wife, who happened to be the only other historian in the year that I came in.
Oh, is that right? Yeah.
And we sort of shared a kind of sense of being outsiders.
Uh-huh.
Grew up in similar kind of middle-class circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
And, so through a long process of what really began as a kind of agonizing deprofessionalization for me, I decided with Lisa to write a book that kind of puts all academic institutions under the microscope.
Uh-huh.
And hopefully at the end of the process, you know, it was a kind of therapy for me because I realized that, the travails of scholars has, you know, been a lot greater and more important than my my own story, over looking back over the millennia.
Uh-huh.
And so, I really came out of it with a very positive sense of not any one academic institution, but the whole sort of chain of them that we talk about in the book.
Yeah, I think that's a terrific perspective, actually. I found it very refreshing because, you know, it isn't so much the story of, and you make this very explicit, it isn't the story of great thinkers, it's the story of great institutions. And I know that I have had the opportunity to kind of look at world history in general, and I find world history very fascinating. And that's really the only way to look at world history, especially, you know, over the very long term, and that is some institutions prove so durable and are so attractive that they spread, and other institutions are neither durable nor do they spread. And the five or six that you pull out in the book, which we'll talk about in a second, are obviously extraordinarily durable.
Yeah.
Yes, their inventors were, you know, I don't know if their inventors were geniuses, but they certainly produced something that stood the test of time.
Yeah.
Why don't we begin by talking about the library? Where does the library come from?
The library comes from ancient Greece. That's not an unknown fact. But what I try to highlight is the way the library broke from the traditions, even betrayed the traditions of classical Athens and sort of democratic Greece. So, you know, we all know from our Plato and our Socrates that oral debate and verbal philosophizing was the kind of coin of the realm and you know, the early philosophical discussions at Athens. In the democratic polis, the political, the city-state.
Is that how you pronounce it?
I'm not a scholar of ancient Greece.
I have no idea.
So that's the way I've been pronouncing it.
Okay, that's fine. Yeah.
One of the tricks of doing kind of, you know, a 2,300-year history is you do end up, you know, waltzing into fields that you don't command every...
Yeah, no, tell me about it. Yeah, no, it's true. So, yeah, so I know what you mean. I had the occasion, actually, to read in more detail than ever before Plato. And, you know, Plato didn't like writing very much.
Right.
He just didn't think it was a good way to do philosophy.
Well, you know, he's on the fence because he, or at least his followers, ended up, you know, committing these debates to writing, making them look spontaneous, making them look like a written record of an oral discourse.
Yeah.
It's an interesting, you know, the dialogue, which is the classic genre he, you know, is known for, is a brilliant, not only a hybrid form, but also a clever piece of ideology because it confronted the sophists who were sort of also practitioners of written scholarship and oral debate, confronted them on their own terms and said, what you're doing is hucksterism and what we're doing is nobler, it's philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
And then a generation or two later with Aristotle, with Aristotle's followers, and this guy, this very interesting guy, Demetrius of Phaleron, who ended up founding the library, reputedly founding the library at Alexandria, they make the shift whole hog from speech to writing.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, they abandon the democratic ethos that had been associated with oral debate and sort of town square philosophizing in order to make Greek scholarship an agent of empire.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think it's a very interesting story, especially, you know, again, I have Plato fresh on my mind, and I'm just reminded of many passages in which I think at one point he even says, only a fool would write down, only if you were really a philosopher, only a fool would write down one's thoughts. Because in a written form, I think he says something like, they stand mute and they cannot respond. And anything that can't respond is obviously of a lower intellectual level, you know, like that of a stone or something.
Right.
But so how did it, you know, again, in that world, a project to gather all of knowledge would involve a lot of memorizing, but the kind of thing that Demetrius did and the librarians at Alexandria was very different. How did they move from one to the other?
No one really knows, but you can sort of map out a converging kind of pattern of both intellectual and political reasons. You know, the intellectual reason had been really started with Aristotle, who looks around at all these different schools, not only Plato's, which he failed to become the leader of himself, the thief in, but many others. And, you know, Aristotle solves this problem of contending schools by synthesizing all of their different debates and points of view in written treatises, and the ones on constitutions and on poetry and everything else that he's known
for. You have a great line, I should say, about I think it's Aristotle's kitchen sink approach to philosophy.
Yeah,
that's very funny.
Yeah, well, I mean, part of this is I always hated Aristotle. I could never see what the big deal was, and some of that I think shines through in the book.
Yeah.
I mean, there are those who find him, as I say, inspiringly capacious, able to synthesize anything, and those who like myself, who never found, you know, there's a beginning, a middle, and an end to everything type of approach as inspiring or attractive as Plato.
Right. Yeah.
But it does set the intellectual stage for written synthetic scholarship, where you're grouping and gathering information and processing it. And then, you know, the big story, the one that I find most interesting is Alexander the Great, is the, you know, the Greek conquest and annexation of the Persian and Egyptian realms of the Mediterranean and the Near East, and the need to somehow project Greek cultural hegemony over that region, to turn it into its place, where Greek is not necessarily the spoken language, but it is the language of power, and patronizing scholars, collecting information, reproducing texts, translating things like the Hebrew Bible,
that's interesting.
The Septuagint into Greek, are all means of solidifying empire. And basically, the way Alexander the Great's generals, like the Ptolemies, portrayed themselves not as thugs or warlords, but as patrons of learning, as those who would weld together this kind of Greek led diasporic community into a ruling class, and that legacy lasts for centuries.
Yeah, it does. I mean, it gives real meat to the notion of a Hellenic world.
Yeah.
That is a place, you know, all over the Eastern Mediterranean where people are doing something like scholarship, or something we would recognize as scholarship, in Greek that could only be done in Greek.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, no, I thought that was a very good part of the book, because people forget that, you know, prior to the Romans, and even during Roman times to some extent, that Greek was really the language of learning. And it remained true in Europe, I think, you know, and they were still fighting it out in the 16th century.
Yeah, it's true.
They didn't
and
know.
The Romans, you know, they just, you know, even when, for a long time under the Romans, Greek remained the language of scholarship, and even as Latin over the centuries began to supplant it. You know, my point is, institutionally, they did the same thing. The language changed, but the means of projecting hegemony through this institution, you know, we now regard as relatively inert, the library, that remained.
Right, right. And so they started gathering willy-nilly in Alexandria, and then the notion of a library sort of spread throughout the Eastern Mediterranean. The Romans had libraries, didn't they?
Yeah, they built them. They either physically carted off books for their private collections, or more notably built public libraries in various parts of their realm, Rome in particular. So, you know, they knew a good thing when they saw it, and that was, you know, an inseparable part of their cultural policy as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, these manuscripts were mostly produced on parchment and what else? Papyrus?
Papyrus. I mean, originally it was papyrus because, above all in Egypt, because papyrus grows in Egypt.
Yeah, right.
The Ptolemies, who ruled Alexandria, put an embargo on papyrus.
Uh-huh.
So that forced those at rival libraries, for example, at Pergamum, to adopt a different material. So Pergamum is the origin of our word parchment.
Parchment, yeah.
An animal skin.
Yeah.
I tend not to emphasize the technology aspect in the book. Whether you're talking about the physical materials or the media that make writing available, because, you know, again, once the model is established, you gather information in a library, you gather text in a library. The choice of writing material, the choice of the scholarly language, all these things can be fudged and changed as centuries went on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there's a kind of fetishism to collecting things, I think, as well. I mean, once you start, it sort of is a self-reinforcing process. You know, people collect Pez dispensers for no reason other than they have five and they want six, and when they have six they want seven more.
Yeah.
And I think I know that I had a book mania myself at one time. Actually, if you were in my office right now, you'd be amazed. I have no books. I gave up on books. I sold my book collection.
Hey,
but
congratulations.
Yeah, it's really quite liberating. I used to collect books like just crazy. And not particularly read them. I would just collect them. So I certainly understand the mania for that kind of thing. But then, so let's move on a little bit. The Roman world collapses in the 5th century. And then you introduce a new institution, the monastery. Maybe you could tell us a little about the origin of that.
Yeah, well, the monastery does not originate as a response to Rome's collapse. It is not pioneered by altruistic, intellectually minded Christians who decide, you know, everything's falling apart, we need to collect it and copy it and save it. I mean, it illustrates a key point of the book, which is that each institution follows its own logic, its own rationale. And in that case, it was spirituality.
Mm-hmm.
The Christians agonized over whether, you know, they should even adopt Greek and Latin learning as a means of elucidating their key texts, and eventually that problem was solved by, among others, St. Augustine.
Mm-hmm.
So the monks and their predecessors, the Christians who inhabited the Mediterranean, had several centuries to kind of think about, do we engage with urban civilization? Do we retreat from it? Do we engage with Greek and Latin learning? Do we turn our backs on it in pursuit of more direct spiritual access to divinity? And so by the time that Rome's collapse was inevitable, they had already crafted a kind of synthesis, which subordinated Greek and Latin learning to the pursuit of spirituality, but gave it a key place nonetheless.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you know the Visigoths are you know and the other barbarians are sacking cities left, right, and center, the monks are already prepared for reasons of their own to carry on traditions of learning,
and
where there isn't a framework for understanding scripture, they bring it with them. They bring even pagan classics, if only as kind of warm-up texts for the real deal, which is the Bible. And the other fascinating thing, the thing I find most fascinating about the monasteries, is that they're programmed to last for centuries.
Uh-huh.
They're programmed to last indefinitely. There are places where you are eagerly awaiting the second coming of Christ, but you have no idea if it's going to happen tomorrow or 6,000 years from now.
Uh-huh.
And so you have to craft a life in such a way that allows you to plod on in what seems to be a mindless routine, but is actually very mindful, very spiritual, very regular, and indeed rule-based.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, the monks do funny things. They neglect manuscripts that we would consider priceless today.
Yep.
Cicero's The Soul of
Copy. Yeah, you mentioned that, yeah.
They literally write over it. It's called a palimpsest. They try to scratch out the Cicero's Republic, because after all, the parchment is very worth it. You know, you have to slaughter an animal to get a piece of parchment.
Right, yeah.
So why not recycle an old pagan text and write, you know, some commentaries on the Psalms? And we look at them as, you look at things like this as an act of vandalism or at best ignorance. You know, the monks were, you know, we thanked them for funneling the legacy of classical antiquity into us, but we're sort of irritated that they didn't do a better job. That's the perspective we inherit from the Renaissance. What they were doing was very well thought out, which was, you know, the pagans didn't know the path to salvation. What the monks needed to know was to know how to live a life in an ascetic, monastic Christian community. And those texts which enabled them to do that, the Rule of St. Benedict, for example, were the ones that they preserved and they cherished and they copied over and over again to this day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One point I want to go back to, because I'm just not clear in my mind about it. I know that originally in the Syriac and in the Egyptian desert, when these Christians ventured off to live alone, writing wasn't and reading wasn't originally part of the program at all.
Right.
How did it become part of the program?
Essentially, they realized that, you know, that you could be a kind of you could be an individual ascetic in which obviously you're not speaking to anyone. You're, for example, sitting atop of a pillar. which is what one guy did. Then they realized, you know, that being a monk, which, you know, comes from the same word mono, being alone, one, was hard to do except for these kind of spiritual athletes. And so they formed communities. They all go out to the desert together. And, you know, almost inevitably they find need of not only scripture to educate them on the, you know, the proper way to live in Christ, but they need ways to regulate themselves. Because you're out there in the desert, you're hungry, you're irritable. You're going to engage in some very unchristian behavior when
yep.
you go clobber your neighbor.
Yep.
And so they, you know, they develop a kind of rudimentary acquaintance with texts as a means of establishing their communities. And it takes a lot of serious, heavy-hitting argument still from people like Augustine to say, hey, let's move beyond that and actually engage, you know, Neoplatonic philosophy and stir that into the mix as well.
Mm-hmm.
That was originally quite alien to the mm-hmm. monastic.
And then, if I recall correctly, they organized, I mean, by the, you know, I'm going to make a date up here, by the 8th or the 9th century, they had developed a kind of intermonastic postal system where they would, and again, correct me if I'm wrong, where they would kind of inventory one another's libraries and decide what needed to be copied and then exchange texts. Does that ring any bells?
Yeah. They go off and they often send missions down to Rome and places like that. You know, the Irish do this quite a bit. And on the way they stop off and they find other monasteries that they don't think are quite rigid enough, and they tell them how to do their job. But yeah, I wouldn't go so far as to call it an intermonastic postal system. these pilgrimages that are staggering, and they're, you know, when you realize that they're trekking across a continent which is still very dangerous.
Yeah.
In order to begin accumulating these texts. So, you know, even though the monks didn't start out with that intellectual vocation, certain among them did to kind of acquire that calling
mm-hmm.
as the centuries wore on.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank goodness for them. So let's move on to our next institution, and that is the university itself. Where do universities come from?
Universities are guilds. They're trade unions, if you want to call them
mm-hmm.
that form to protect certain occupational groups. In this case, students who are in it, in part for the intellectual payoff, but also for to make money in law or medicine or even preaching and theology. And they're the ones who really do begin, as Europe's civilization revives in the 11th and 12th centuries, to take off across what is, again, still a very dangerous countryside. You know, there are highwaymen, there are they're robbers on the road, and when they do show up in towns like Paris and Bologna, the sites of the first universities, they don't have many rights. They're foreigners,
mm-hmm.
If you come from England and you wind up in Italy, some local tavern owner says, "Hey, I met a guy from England, and he skipped out on his bar tab. So why don't you pay?"
You mentioned that, because that's what the Russians used to do. You know, foreign traders would come and they'd say, "Okay, you come from England? Yeah, I come from England. Well, there's just an Englishman here, and he didn't pay up, so we're going to put you in prison until you pay." And he's like, "But I don't know anything. I don't know this guy."
Whenever you go to a foreign country, they assume that, you know, I've met someone else.
Go ahead. I'm sorry to interrupt.
Eventually the students and the masters, as they were called, realized the need to kind of band together in defense of common interests.
Uh-huh.
And the word universitas is obviously a Latin word that refers to a corporation, and
uh-huh.
in this case, a corporation of scholars. But you could refer to any occupational group as an universitas. So there's
uh-huh.
nothing sort of special about scholars originally, and it's just because they tended to be among the most mobile, along with, you know, troubadours and crusaders and other people who were just sort of hitting the road in the 12th century. And from the germs of these kind of occupational unions come full-fledged guilds with the caps and the gowns and the robes and the what today are staggering privileges. I mean, they had legal jurisdiction over themselves.
And so if
you went out, this was often the case, and got in a barroom brawl and, you know, fatally injured a townsman, there was actually the possibility that you'd be tried by your own professor
mm-hmm.
rather than by the municipal or the royal authority.
I like that idea. Oh, wait, no, I...
Yeah, well,
yeah.
You know, professors always, you know, they had this kind of boys will be boys attitude.
Yeah.
Of course, it was all men
yeah.
at the time. And so this eventually caused the for example, the King of France to become enraged. That these students were literally getting away with murder in some cases.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the guild eventually lost jurisdiction over capital crimes and rape and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a pretty raucous world.
Mm-hmm.
It was a pretty violent world.
When did they start to take on a kind of modern institutional form where, you know, and I'm thinking like the kernel of the university being the class. That is, you know, you enroll in a class as opposed to just studying with a master.
You do that from the beginning because you can study with many different masters.
Mm-hmm.
Again, the format is not so much what interests me as the reasons it's undertaken.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of leaping ahead to chapter 5 in the book, we see the university reinvented after a period of decline and marginalization, and that's when we begin to see a lot of the features of contemporary research universities emerge.
Mm-hmm. And what are some of the peculiarities of the university? I mean, one of the things I think that most people would be shocked by is that universities really didn't have libraries. That they, that wasn't considered to be an important facet. Why is that exactly?
Well, the heart of learning in the medieval university was particularly the disputation, and this is one thing that I wish we'd bring back.
Mm-hmm.
Because the point was, you know, you had to have books. You would commission them from a local stationer. A lot of these stationers on the left bank of the Seine in Paris are still there in different forms as bookstores. 800 and some years later, but that was only preparatory to a verbal joust. I mean, these are literally going on at the same time as knights are out there with their lances, and scholars are doing the same thing. It's a very masculine, very aggressive culture where you prove yourself by essentially, you know, preening like a peacock, impressing the master, and then solving some kind of theological problem.
Mm-hmm.
To the satisfaction of the, you know, the assembled masters.
Yep.
So it's only when universities much later come to acquire a research mission that they need libraries to collect texts. That's not their original, not originally part of their institutional profile.
Yeah, the vestiges of that kind of performative aspect still survive in a couple of places. I mean, we give oral exams to PhD students, for example, and sometimes we even give them to undergraduates. So there's a little of that left, yeah.
Voce.
Pardon me?
We even call them viva voce.
Yeah, viva voce. That's exactly right. Yeah, no, that's right. So that's you know, there are that kind of, I want to call them atavisms. They are there are the remnants of those things. So in general, what role did the university in this sort of medieval form play in the kind of preservation of knowledge?
I would say that in every case, no institution has aimed primarily to preserve knowledge.
Yeah.
And that's kind of one of the big what I hope will be a surprising revelation.
Mm-hmm.
But they all preserve knowledge for some larger end.
Mm-hmm.
Right? In the case of the university, it's to serve the kind of West's first knowledge economy.
Mm-hmm.
The time when civilization is reviving and people need lawyers, they need doctors, they need preachers above all, as heretics begin to sort of have other ideas about Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
And so everything that's preserved, everything that's produced, everything that's debated is serving that larger end of producing a professional, degreed, credentialed professionals who can sort out, how do you get by with charging interest even though it's not a biblically practice, for example.
Mm-hmm.
How do you get rid of these Cathar heretics who are coming in with these crazy ideas? And so that is how it fit in. And every institution serves ultimately the society that where it first gestates.
Yeah, they're adapted to and emerge from a kind of particular historical context, which is just what we'd expect. Yeah, I mean, the internet does not exist to preserve knowledge. It may do that, but it clearly doesn't exist for that purpose. So anyway, let's go on then to the Republic of Letters. What is its greater purpose?
Its greater purpose, it's originally a correspondence network to knit scholars together after the Protestant Reformation tears the university world apart, along with the rest of Europe.
Mm-hmm.
So universities, you know, continue to exist. We're talking here about basically the Renaissance and the early modern period.
Mm-hmm.
Universities continue to exist, but they become more like ideological boot camps,
mm-hmm.
Protestant or Catholic,
mm-hmm.
Especially in the case, for example, the Jesuit colleges. And so, you know, people like Erasmus famously take to writing letters,
mm-hmm.
saying, you know, hey, Martin, you're my friend Martin Luther. You
mm-hmm.
know, can't you just tone it down a little bit?
Mm-hmm.
They begin to adopt other media like books.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Republic of Letters comes about as, you know, I hate to make these analogies too explicit, but it's like the sort of 16th century internet.
Mm-hmm.
It's a network without nodes.
Mm-hmm.
It's a form in which ideas can be shared once the face-to-face verbal community of the universities becomes polarized by
mm-hmm.
People like Luther, who are professors, they're great debaters, they're great at eviscerating their opponents,
mm-hmm.
and they begin to do so in the name of one or another version of Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
And the surprising story to emerge from that is that that becomes the incubator for what we now call the scientific revolution,
mm-hmm.
for the processing of you know, the Copernican revolution, the Columbus's explorations, etc. That wasn't its original purpose, but it proved supremely well adapted to processing new research findings.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I mean, I see what you mean, because, again, one of the things I think people are always surprised to learn is that, you know, especially in the 16th century after the Reformation, 17th century, that universities were not places where research was undertaken, really.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, if you think...
They really had been,
yeah.
except, you know, by hook or by crook, by
yeah.
individual scholars who had a vocation for that.
Yeah, I mean, if we think about, you know, sort of the early scholarly societies, none of them, I think, were found, I don't know, none of them, that's probably an exaggeration, but most of them were not founded at universities, nor did they have institutional affiliations
right.
of that sort. So,
right.
and the people that did the work often did not work in universities,
yeah.
although we tend to kind of retrospectively put them in a university context.
Yeah, I mean, Galileo had a university chair, et cetera, but... You know, his real work is done, you know, for example, in the Accademia dei Lincei.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, yeah, these academies become stirred into the Republic of Letters, too, as lay people become, you know, essentially disgusted with the professors and the pedantries that they're purveying.
Uh-huh.
So you get, though, the academies, museums, books, letters, they're all sort of stirred into this big mix we call the Republic of Letters.
Yeah, so it's a kind of a different, there's a moment at which the library, the monastery, and the university have a certain coherence that the Republic of Letters doesn't. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah.
At least that's what I thought.
Yeah, things get complicated as you move out of these, you know, these kind of bricks and mortar
institutions. Sure, yeah.
And that, I think that's what makes them all the more impressive, because the Republic of Letters really begins... as a desperate attempt simply to sit down, write a letter, adopt the conventions of Ciceronian humanist rhetoric, and knit some sort of international scholarly community back together, when, you know, the big players are literally, you know, killing each other in
mm-hmm.
civil war.
Mm-hmm.
It's a way of repackaging what we already know about the Renaissance and the early modern period,
mm-hmm.
hopefully heightening the drama, not so much of the intellectual breakthroughs, great as though they may be, you know,
mm-hmm.
the Copernican system, for example, but the institutional achievement that came about to enable those inventions to take off,
mm-hmm.
to enable Galileo's defense
mm-hmm.
of Copernicus to survive, even as he was being hauled before the Inquisition.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And those things prove unbelievably durable,
mm-hmm.
Not so much the academy, but certainly the book and the museum.
Yeah, no, certainly, that's right. Yeah, no, I know that I remember reading articles about the museums of curiosities that people would, which are truly incredible. They're literally, you know, collections of everything imaginable. And they're quite, it must have been quite wonderful to see.
Yeah, and we've got great sort of, if you couldn't actually go to one and see that, like, they love embalmed crocodiles, for example, you could see them pictured in books with really elaborate copperplate illustrations. Well, I couldn't be there, but here's all these things that they're, you know, you can't really find in your Ptolemy or your Pliny or your ancient text,
uh-huh.
That are coming from the four corners of the earth.
Yeah, no, yeah. No,
very exciting.
Yeah, it is very interesting. So let's move on then to our next set of Really, it's a set of institutions, and that is the disciplines themselves, which turn out to be remarkably modern.
Yeah, yeah. They, I mean, at some level, this is just a natural specialization that fits in any kind of Adam Smith type of market for knowledge, and so people begin to specialize. And the surprising the point there, though, is that people have expected. There's been a lot of attention lavished, for example, on the French encyclopedia. It provides specialized knowledge to the public in the most high-tech medium available at the time, the printed book.
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, not everyone, but many people have fully expected that a well-educated young man or woman would simply pick up an encyclopedia and sort of cart it around forever, you know, and thereby gain the education one needs of his or her life.
Mm-hmm.
So, what happens surprisingly is the university, not the encyclopedia, becomes redeemed. And so all of a sudden, you know, as we now know, that you don't get, you know, a set of quality encyclopedias when you graduate. You go off to college and
uh-huh.
You go off to university. And the people who first made the university a newly re-enlivened site of learning were evangelical Protestants.
Uh-huh.
And historically, they're the only people who have a commitment to teaching everybody how to read.
Uh-huh.
But have the Word of God in your native language in order to acquire salvation.
Mm-hmm.
And they come up with seminaries. Seminaries become seminars. Religious instruction gives way to classical languages. And from that seminar model, every discipline we now recognize, all the ologies, all the majors in the research university
mm-hmm.
is derived.
And this is about when?
This is around 1800.
Okay. Yeah,
and it starts in Germany, which is the unlikeliest of places,
mm-hmm.
the backward, fragmented country.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone would have expected it to be in France or England, the sort of harbingers of modernity.
Mm-hmm.
And it happens at the moment Germany is defeated by Napoleon.
Mm-hmm.
Napoleon represents utilitarian French knowledge at its sort of most extreme. And the Germans react to being defeated by Napoleon by founding Ivory Tower Haven.
Mm-hmm.
Seems like a dumb move.
Yeah, it does.
but the Germans dominate the 19th century. They're,
yeah.
They're the you know, everybody flocks. 10,000 Americans go to Germany to study at the feet of the greats in
yeah.
the field of learning.
And so they had actually organized the university in faculties at that point, kind of modern faculties. That is, you know, the things that we know and love now, chemistry and history and philosophy and these things. Is that correct?
Yeah, yeah. But they didn't, I mean, the brilliant thing, and I wish, you know, we still had some of this now, is that they're not organized like guilds.
Mm-hmm.
It is a free market system where anybody who wants to lecture, if you want to lecture in philosophy at the University of Berlin, you just show up
uh-huh.
and you say, I'm going to be giving a lecture and what the heck, I'm going to schedule it at the same time as Hegel. I'm smarter than him.
Yeah.
And this is what Schopenhauer did. He failed. He couldn't actually best Hegel.
Yeah.
But the brilliant thing was that, you know, whereas contemporary faculties and departments have regained some of the insularity
yeah.
and the guild-like spirit of their medieval forebears, around about 1800, 1850, it was a freewheeling marketplace of ideas,
mm-hmm.
and that's what enables anybody to specialize at will and to sort of offer a new intellectual product in these systems of mass education that the Germans had pioneered.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And who went to university in the 19th century in Germany?
Anyone who had you know, sort of graduated with the Abitur, the you know, the highest degree of
uh-huh.
high school learning,
uh-huh.
And, you know, either wanted a professional degree or wanted to get another professorial perch somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So the idea was that, you know, this was still a very elite institution
mm-hmm.
in the sense that not, you know, not everyone by any means aspired to it. But it's at the same time a meritocracy. You don't
mm-hmm.
have to be from a wealthy family. It's designed to take kind of poor preacher sons and make them into the kind of shock troops of Germany's modernization.
Mm-hmm.
Whether
mm-hmm.
as civil servants or doctors or lawyers or professors, it's, you know, we would call it today a huge investment in human capital
mm-hmm.
In the aftermath of Napoleon's defeat of Germany.
Mm-hmm. And these were state-funded institutions, correct?
Yeah, yeah. The state, you know, the state sets them up. They buy, you know, they heat the lecture rooms. They pay the salaries of the chaired professors. But those who aren't chairs, you know, the guys who are just starting out, they live off the lecture fees of their students.
Mm-hmm.
So they have an incentive to pack the rooms. And then once they get a certain amount of notoriety, then they can get a chair, which is just, you know, then you're set for life. It's
mm-hmm.
like 10 years.
Mm-hmm. So how does this model spread? I mean, I know a little bit about the American case because, you
right.
know, I think if I recall correctly, it's Johns Hopkins is the first to sort of adopt
yeah.
this model, and then it spreads throughout the United States. But if you could talk a little bit about how it spreads, I'd be interested.
Yeah, well, everyone, you know, the great thing about especially the Anglo-American tradition is that, you know, we're always reinventing things and calling them by old names.
Yeah.
So, you know, there are plenty of colleges in the United States already, Harvard, for example. And then there are a couple of new places like Johns Hopkins, which are explicitly founded in imitation of the German model.
Mm-hmm.
But in places like Harvard, later on in places like Oxford and Cambridge, they begin to adopt Germanic-style research orientation,
mm-hmm.
even while keeping some of their old traditions, you know, their
mm-hmm.
old IB and their old... you know, sherry hours and things like this
mm-hmm.
that make it look like continuity. But you know, I would argue, you know, beneath that continuity, there's a huge revolution going on, and it is essentially from individual pilgrims who go to Germany, you know, and these could include people who, you know, like university reformers or W.E.B. Du Bois, you know, all
uh-huh.
types of people who that's where the action is in the 19th century,
yeah.
believe it or not. And they come back and they just sort of work their way through the system and they change the norms. And eventually you get an administrative structure called the department
uh-huh.
in the American university, which has a certain amount of, it's buffered against interference from university administrators who are, you know, in that period of the century, almost beneath contempt as far as their intellectual
yeah.
Credentials are concerned.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Yeah. No, I thought that I remember one time I read something about history departments circa 1900, and generally speaking, it was the case that people studied history,
uh-huh.
and that was it. You
right.
didn't, there was no differentiation. You didn't
yeah.
say German history, Polish history, or Chinese
yeah.
history. You studied history. And I always thought that was very liberating.
Yeah. No, I wish we could go back to
yeah.
that. One of the things I'm trying to do with
yeah.
the book is transgress these
yeah you and boundaries. Me you and me both
yeah
yeah but I thought that was yeah it was extraordinarily
yeah.
refreshing that they thought in that way. So what do you, could maybe I don't know if you know this or not, but at what point did the actual disciplines within history develop and it kind of assume their modern form? I really don't know the answer to that question.
I would say circa 1900, but I would say also that it's in the dynamic of any large marketplace to produce subspecialists and sub-subspecialists
mm-hmm.
and so on. So, as soon as any one person decides, I'm going to be a Polish historian, not just a general historian,
mm-hmm.
and attracts a sufficient number of acolytes to train them and send them off to jobs elsewhere,
yeah.
then you've got a sub-discipline going.
Yeah, no, I think that's
and
right.
And the conferences and the journals just kind of follow in the wake of that.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, just to digress for a second, I think I'm a little older than you are, but I know that when I had written my sort of second book on early modern Russian history, and then the department came to me and they said, what's your next project going to be? I just said, I don't want to study early modern Russian history anymore. I know enough about it. I know everything
yeah.
I need to know about this. And actually, in the German system, they do it a little bit differently because one of the things they say is that you have to work across fields or you have to work
yes.
across time periods.
Right.
And we just don't do that here. I mean, if
yeah.
you're an early modern Russian historian to start with, that's the way you end. And I didn't have the, you know, sort of stick-to-itiveness to do it. And I find it, like, for example, my wife, the mathematician, I tell her that this is the way the historical discipline works, and she's just
right.
amazed
yeah.
that you would
yeah.
study one thing your whole life.
Right.
And I got to say,
I think that's part of the incentive structure that's still around
yeah.
of all the disciplines. You know, you attain stature by depth rather than breadth.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, I left academia because of it. I just couldn't do it anymore. And then, I mean, I came back kind of by happenstance, but
uh-huh.
under a condition in which I could actually study something a little bit different. I still do
right.
Russian history, but I also, you know, have irons in other fires, which
yeah.
I don't know. I just couldn't do it.
Yeah, I hear you. I thought about leaving academia many times on that.
Yeah, because I just couldn't do it anymore. But which isn't to say early modern Russian history is not a great field. It really is, and the people who do it are absolutely fantastic. It's just that the way the historical disciplines are structured, I don't know. I just found myself answering the same questions over and over again.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I never heard anything new. But, I mean, again, maybe that's a peculiarity of my own discipline, and maybe American historians or something don't have this problem. But
you know, I think it's true, you know, probably of everyone, even in different fields as well.
And
different certain fields are better at bridging those gaps, you know, those problems than others.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I think that's right. But anyway, here at Iowa, I'm very blessed. They let me do pretty much what I want, which is it's extraordinarily nice. We have one more set of institutions to talk about, and that is the laboratory. Why don't you tell us a little bit about the origins of that?
Yeah, the laboratory originates in the sort of academies of the Republic of Letters, and later on in the, you know, the seminars in chemistry and other fields in the research university or in the disciplines. But they you know, they have to, they battle this problem that the, especially the classical scholars in the research university, the scholars of Greek and Latin, don't really think that what they're doing in these laboratories amounts to knowledge. You know, they're making soap. they're not doing something worthy of the ancients. And it takes a long time, you know, before people like Pasteur say, well, you know, I may be doing this sort of, you know, grubby practical work, but, you know, I can actually cure people who are suffering disease. And, you know, how much can your Plato and your Aristotle do that?
Mm-hmm.
So the laboratory battles for a place within the disciplines and eventually triumphs completely.
Mm-hmm.
When they get all their different departments, and they triumph first of all by manipulating nature within physical confined spaces, you know, the rooms where laboratory science goes on. But then they, you know, they go on to conquer the rest of the world in many ways as well. What I argue in the book is that the late 19th century, the processes of industrialization, urbanization, they spawn new public spaces that laboratory scientists and their imitators could then begin to control, things like the public school, the factory floor, the office building, the immigrant slum. None of these spaces had existed before, at least not on the scale that industrial modernity created them.
Mm-hmm.
You needed a way, for example, in the public school to shunt the what were called feeble-minded off into special education. And you needed an IQ test to do that. The guy who came up with the IQ test said, you know, let's not call them feeble-minded. Let's call them something more respectful, like morons. That was his coinage.
Yeah.
Don't call my son feeble-minded.
Call him a moron. That's funny.
So, yeah, they, I mean, they go through the management consultants, our, you know, our laboratory scientists who play in the workplace. And so, you know, the laboratory, this is what the book ends with, essentially, is the laboratory is looming ever larger as an institution, not just in the hard sciences, but in society at large. And I don't see any end to that that sort of secular trend, at least not yet.
No, I don't either. Absolutely, I think that's true. I mean, there's more and more emphasis on data gathering and manipulation. I mean, that, that pretty much is, I mean, you know, one of the things I also do here is teach graduate students, and I tell them that that is sort of what we do. We, you know, among many other things, we gather data and manipulate it, and for good or ill. I don't know if I'm making better people or not, but I am gathering data and manipulating it. So, yeah, this it's not for, you know, it's not for no reason that the spreadsheet, which is a peculiar thing, has become, you know, a kind of common coin throughout America. Everyone knows what a spreadsheet is. I don't think in the 18th century people knew what a ledger was.
They did, but they were, you know, they restricted it to certain things like commerce, you know, that for which it was very well adapted. But,
It's funny because I used to work at a magazine, and you know, magazine of all places, you know, and I became known as the guy in the office that knew how to use Excel. That was my purchase at the place. I was the guy who knew how to use Excel. At a magazine, you know, it was a really strange thing. I quite agree with you about the laboratory in that way. Well, you closed the book with some words about the Internet. Maybe you could talk a little about that.
Yeah. I mean, I don't see the Internet as in itself a technological revolution, or at least not on the scale of these big institutions that I've been talking about. It's clearly an amazingly inventive and useful technology. I see it rather as the latest, you know, perhaps greatest sign of the laboratory's institutional ascendancy. One of the many things the laboratory does is to create information, is to divorce facts from their lived context and to enable them to be transmitted as electronic pulses over fiber optic cable. And that has led, you know, to all the things the Internet can do, including, you know, attempts to kind of revive the dream of ancient Alexandria.
Mm-hmm.
So I see the internet less on its own terms as a technology. I mean, throughout the book, I de-emphasize technology. I don't talk about parchment and papyrus. I don't actually talk very much about the invention of a book, which
mm-hmm.
is used to be seen as creating a revolution in consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
I don't believe that.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things that happens every time a new institution comes along is that it repurposes and supersedes its predecessor.
Mm-hmm.
So just as the monastery absorbed libraries and books and made them serve not a political end, but a religious end.
Mm-hmm.
Surprisingly enough, the laboratory is in the midway through the process of gobbling up and repurposing the disciplines in the research university.
Mm-hmm.
And all of us who sort of labor in the humanistic core of the research university, I'm not saying that in 20 years we'll be the indentured servants of men and women in lab coats and safety goggles. But I think that what our society demands out of knowledge is increasingly be provided by the laboratory and not by the classical, especially the humanistic disciplines.
Mm-hmm.
And we're all going to have to adapt as a result.
It's funny you mentioned that because I was just doing some writing myself, and actually this doesn't quite fit your chronological framework, but it's I think, evocative at least. You know, in the 1950s, public intellectuals wrote books like The Lonely Crowd and The One-Dimensional Man and things like this. And now public intellectuals write books like The Tipping Point and The Wisdom of Crowds.
Yeah.
These are extraordinarily different public intellectual books. One, you know, the latter of them are really about kind of, you know, they're like public goods experiments upon which entire books have been written. They're about marketing, really, and you know, The Lonely Crowd and The One-Dimensional Man were not about marketing.
Right. Well, both in their content and in their production. I mean, not only are they about, you know, large-scale laboratory-like phenomena like the tipping point, but they're in this feedback loop with marketing that, you know, the content becomes tweaked and adjusted in response to reader demand.
Yeah.
And the marketing of the books is in itself a grand-scale social science experiment.
Yeah, it is.
And it's much more profitable than social scientists who work in
research. Yeah, no, absolutely. No question about it. No, really, it's true. So I do kind of wonder about the future of our own project because, I mean, I know that I've always been quite an empiricist myself and a kind of unreconstructed positivist, but your book gave me pause, actually, to think how I had been. I was sort of in this stream of laboratory science and that I really do treat it in a kind of, with a scientific mindset. I really do. You know, I treat it just the way, you know, that I would treat any other data, but it's really a very different project. And I also really like what you say about, you know, each succeeding institution kind of enfolding the one that came before it and adapting it to its purpose, because I think that's absolutely right.
And it was a struggle for me to come to that conclusion because I'd gone along throughout the whole project thinking that each old institution simply stays in place. I mean, after all, we still have libraries. Heck, we still even have monasteries.
Yeah.
And the implication of what I ultimately argued was that, you know, you and I are condemned to, at best, second-rate citizens.
Yeah, no, we are. No, it's true.
Complete marginalization. Yeah. It is very depressing, but...
It's...
It provides a framework for what we're living in now.
I think it provides a nice, it offers us a nice perspective on what's really going on. I mean, it's in a certain sense, it's a cautionary tale because what your book says is we actually live in a kind of discrete moment. We don't think that we do, but it will also pass, and some other institution will come, and it will absorb the institutions that we have currently invented, and they will be unrecognizable in 150 or 200 years. If we were to be flashed forward 150 years to, you know, whatever institution we live in now, it will have been evolved or adapted to whatever institutional context exists in 150 years, and we'll be strangers in that strange place. So,
and if historians could ever predict what's coming next, we'd be the richest people on
earth. Yeah, no, that's no question about that.
It's unpredictable.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. I actually wrote a book where I predicted something once, and needless to say, I was wrong. Just because of that thing. Well, Ian, we've really spent a lot of your time, and we appreciate having you on the show very, very much. It's, you know, it's a terrific book. We'd like to close with our traditional question, which is, what are you working on now?
Well, I decided that 2,300 years of Western history wasn't enough, so I'm going to try to do some way the rest of the world next.
Uh-huh.
One of the things that I folded in, began to fold into this one, is his attention to China and India and the Islamic world, which each possess their own knowledge traditions. And it remained vital down to the 19th century. It's only in the last 100 or so years that each has in its own way contended with or even yielded to the Western model. So within that broad framework, I've got a, obviously the practitioner of world history needs to figure out some way of wrestling an absurdly large topic into the proper shape and size.
Yeah, we should talk more about this, because this is exactly what I'm wrestling with too, because I've started to work more and more in world history, and really how to shape it is extraordinarily important question, because we don't know yet. We don't even really know what the data is yet. I've been really wrestling with that. I mean, what makes a particular datum world historical as opposed to, say, German historical or something? I can't figure that out yet.
and the amount of specialized expertise you need to do in any one of these sub-specialties.
Yeah, it's a daunting task, but I think it's an intellectually very rich task. And I should say that all historians in the United States and the world should be very grateful to you for taking it on, because this is a really terrific book. I'd like to congratulate you and Lisa on it, and I hope that it is tremendously successful. I really do. I hope it reaches a wide readership. So anyway, thanks very much for being on the show today. I appreciate it.
Thanks very much for having me.
Okay, take care now. Bye-bye.
All right, bye-bye.
You've been listening to an interview with Ian McNeely about his new book, Reinventing Knowledge: From Alexandria to the Internet, co-authored with Lisa Wolverton. It's recently appeared from W.W. Norton. I'm Marshall Poe, the host of New Books in History. I hope that you have a good week.